This episode is an exclusive insight into the views of the Elgium investment team on what's happening in markets and what this means for investors. This podcast is intended for investment professionals, and if you're enjoying Elgium Talks, why not subscribe in your Apple Podcasts or Spotify app and never miss another episode.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from Elgium. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Bill Hughes, Head of Real Assets, and Tim Dougal, Head of Investment Advisory. As we did last time, we're going to touch on some of the themes raised in our recently published CIO outlook, which also helped to explain the fragility in investor sentiment that has been on display since then. On that note, Sonia, could you please give us an update on the health of the global economy and the state of financial markets?
With great pleasure. Thank you very much, Max, and a very warm welcome to this week's call. As always, I hope you're joining us healthy and safe. As usual, I would like to start giving you a quick update on the virus developments, the economy, and then obviously to have a snapshot of the current market environment. But I'm very pleased to be joined today by Bill and Tim to give you an update on two very important areas of the market. So if you look at the virus developments, then it's very clear that we have seen quite a bit of a change in the tone. As you recall, obviously, over the past couple of weeks, the sentiment and the focus has been very much on reopening, lifting restrictions, and obviously restarting the economy. And as you will see later on, that so far has been quite successful, and early indicators show that economies actually are recovering quite quickly. Now, yesterday, we unfortunately had a bit of a dampener because the U.S. reported very sadly the record largest one-day increase. And if you look across to Latin America, then Brazil, then not far behind. And in fact, it's those two countries that are now the worst impacted globally, number one, the U.S., and number two, Brazil. That you can see very clearly on the chart in front of you, not only obviously the dramatic increase across the emerging markets, but secondly, although not quite as visible yet, you see that actually the slightly darker blue line is ticking up again. That is the U.S., and we have seen, obviously, over the past couple of days, quite a large increase across a number of states, and so this is definitely one we will watch very carefully. We've had negative news from Germany as well, where regionally there was a flare-up across a meat, you know, processing company, and hence the city of Göttingen now is in full lockdown. And I guess we have to get used that on a regional basis, we will see more of this happening in the context of economies reopening. And as such, you know, we have to be mindful, as we've said all along, that this might have a dampening impact on the economic development. Now, what we do know as well is, and if you look at the next slide here, we know that lockdown was actually applied very quickly, and hence obviously we have seen the dramatic impact on the economy, literally falling off a cliff with everything being shut down. Now the reverse might not be as abrupt, and we have had obviously more information from the government this week, and as we have seen within those announcements, the opening up is a lot more difficult. There's a lot more considerations that feed into those lifting of restrictions, and as such, we might see a slightly different picture emerge across various countries. Now, coming back to the U.S., because that clearly is something that we need to watch very carefully, not only that the U.S. already has 2.3 million cases and more than 121,000 deaths, but you see very clearly on the left-hand side of this chart that in some states, California, Florida, Texas, and Arizona in particular, there has been a dramatic jump in new cases over the recent weeks, as much as that New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo has now imposed a quarantine on people arriving from these states into New York. So that clearly will be something to watch. And interestingly, if you see on the right-hand side, it seems that there is obviously a link to the election and hence the political government in the respective states. So we are very clear and very sure that this will definitely be hotly debated through the upcoming election. And you might have seen that Joe Biden actually currently leads by 16 points versus Trump. So there will be more pressure in this balancing act between new cases and opening the economy. Now, when it comes to the economic development, our scenarios, as you can see here on this page, they have not changed. Just to remind you, the biggest difference between scenario one and two is the understanding of long-term economic scarring and obviously the potential risk of a second wave. As you will see on this next slide, and as we have highlighted a number of times, the initial recovery was always expected to look very similar and depends a lot on the speed with which restrictions are lifted. And as you can see very clearly here in the US, for the time being, this is a very neat V-shaped recovery. And you see the green line, which is our growth tracker, and which looks very much at high frequency and short-term indicators, looks quite strong, which clearly has helped markets over the recent time period as well. Now, one aspect that we are watching very carefully is not only a potential second wave and the implication this might have on the economic development going forward. The other part that we've highlighted a couple of times is the idea of economic scarring, i.e. the understanding of the longer lasting implications on the job market in particular, and that's the area we are highlighting here, because we have to understand that for the time being, there is a lot of government support that is provided to companies and individuals to dampen the negative impact. To give you an idea of this, in the UK currently, we still have 9 million people in furlough schemes, which is 1 in 4 employees here in the UK. Similarly, in Germany, there's 12 million people in the so-called Kurzarbeit, i.e. the short-term working arrangement. Again, it is 1 in 4 employees. And we have in the US 20 to 30 million people supported by the so-called Paycheck Protection Program, which is quite a generous program released by the government to support unemployed people, which means we have for the time being simply postponed the inevitable that companies will have to look at their workforce and decide, you know, how many they can take back. There will be sectors that, above all, will be impacted by the longer-term implication of COVID-19. Travel and leisure in particular is one we will watch very carefully. Qantas this morning announced that they will let go 20% of their workforce. And that is this kind of part of the equation on the right-hand side that we call the reallocation shock, and simply means that there will be a lot of people that cannot come back to the jobs they had prior to COVID-19, and hence probably will provide quite a dampening impact on the longer-term economic development. But coming back to Europe, again, the picture that I showed you just now for the US is now showing signs of life in Europe as well. So similarly, short-term indicators point to a relatively robust development. But as I said, everything I've just said in terms of the US context applies to Europe as well. And there will be a very strong focus of all governments to dampen the potential impact on longer-term unemployment and how to make sure that there is sufficient support underway. Now, I've highlighted the US election already, and I think it's very clear that it's not only the pandemic that will weigh on this year's election and will be a major theme, in particular in the context of the economic developments, but it is the tension between the US and China that clearly is will be dominating. And you see a snapshot here that the view of America towards China has changed quite dramatically and has moved decisively into an unfavorable territory. So again, it will be very interesting to see how both candidates will pick up that topic in their campaign trail. Now, moving to markets, and I will skip this slide here because I think for us now the important question is, with markets having recovered, which you see very nicely here on that slide in front of you, with markets having recovered to a large extent the losses experienced throughout March, the big question for market participants is how much of the good news is priced in and what is market's expectation for the continuation of the economic recovery. If you see the shape of the recovery market, it's very clear that the V-shape is that is the expectation for market participants. And we think that actually there is a bit of caution warranted because we will have to see what the long-term implications are, particularly around unemployment and the consequences of those shifts that we have highlighted a number of times throughout our calls. What are the long-term implications of COVID-19 on consumer behavior, on the way how companies will think about their workforce, think about supply chains, and hence, obviously, is the market too optimistic on this being such a swift kind of going back to pre-COVID-19 times? And as such, you know, we've highlighted a couple of times that we would definitely encourage people to be more focused on who might be structural long-term winners and who, first and foremost, has the strength and the sustainable business model and balance sheet to sustain that period of stress. We've spoken about this particularly in the context of credit, because as you know, it is very difficult, or put differently, you need a lot of winners to make up for one big loser. And I think there have been a couple of very interesting cases already. Wirecard is the last one in Germany, which probably is not necessarily a victim of the pandemic. But again, it shows you how exposed you can be to one individual position, and it will require quite a few positive positions on the other side to make up for one loser. We have seen a number of downgrades, high-profile downgrades, and we are very sure that there's more to come. And as such, we believe it is definitely warranted to be very mindful and cautious on the investment positions and investment opportunities. But as we've said a number of times, there will be a lot of opportunities. And I think in that context, real estate, real assets and property is a very good case to look at. And I know that Bill last time already shared a few thoughts on the longer term implications. And I'm very pleased to have him here again to share and to give an update on where we stand today. But first and foremost, back to Max. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that update, Sonia. And yes, let's move to Bill now. Bill, this is a question we received from one of our clients. How has COVID-19 impacted deal flow and asset prices in the private markets in which you invest?
Yeah, morning, everybody. Thank you, Max. Of course, it's worth saying before I talk about deal flow and pricing, of course, one of the key features of private markets is the opacity of what's going on versus the market dynamic that Sonia described, where everyone can see it in terms of prices and trading levels. So it's been very challenging because against the background we've seen, it's definitely been a world characterized by incredibly low deal flow, particularly in real estate equity. The volume of transactions that are in any way indicative of a normal market have been incredibly limited. And if you ask yourself the question, why will you be a seller in this market, I think you can probably then start to think about why levels of transaction volume have been so low. And as a consequence of that, it's been very hard to find any sort of base in prices. I think price discovery has not happened particularly effectively because of the low levels of transaction volume. In private credit, it's not dissimilar, but there are some areas there where there's still deal flow happening, particularly in and around utilities and renewables, where there are some companies looking for additional sources of funding, and there's a reasonably active market, actually, particularly in the US, much more so than in Europe. So I would certainly characterize the market we're in as being a place where confidence in asset values is challenged, and we're some way from receiving a stabilization in values, and also widespread confidence in where values are at. So at this point in time, I would say that volumes are going to stay low, and there's a bit of a chicken and egg here, because the reason volumes are staying low is because people don't have confidence in pricing, and that, of course, keeps transaction volumes low. I'd also say that it's worth, against the background of what Sonia was saying there, it's worth remembering, really, in the time frame we've been in lockdown, around about one quarter, course, it takes some time for the impact of that to come through in terms of the trading performance of businesses. It takes a while for that to impact their liquidity. And right now, as we sit here towards the end of June, towards the end of the second quarter, I certainly see some difficult quarters ahead in terms of how this will actually impact upon the real estate and real asset sector that has got a lot really to be concerned by.
Right. Well, staying with that theme, insofar as it's possible to discern, bearing in mind your comments about how opaque the market can be, what are real estate and private credit markets telling us about the outlook, and how is Elgin Real Assets positioning across these markets?
Yeah, Max, in a way, I think there's an inevitable flight to quality in this environment. We've seen that before. When the market is in any sort of distress, you'd expect quality assets to be the assets that are favoured. And that's two things. That's about risk appetite in the immediate circumstances. But it's also telling you something about the assets that investors believe in the medium long term. And so in the real estate world, there is no doubt that well-located assets that are positioned for a world post-COVID, and we'll come on to that in a second, are relatively well sought, and where the values have fallen less. And in the world of private credit, I think well-structured transactions with high-quality counterparties that are seen as being relatively resilient. Again, clearly those sorts of assets in a flight-to-quality world are more favoured. And again, I think that tells you something about the perception of the medium-term calibre of those investments too. So if you look at our existing portfolio and where we're positioned, and I did say a little bit about this last time around, we're certainly in a relatively strong position versus the market, because we have for some time been concentrating on what we consider to be both good quality assets, high quality assets in current circumstances pre-COVID, but also we do spend time thinking about how would the world evolve and what good looks like. And at this point, I think I would probably emphasize that for real assets, very largely, I think COVID, more than anything, represents an acceleration of trends that we were seeing beforehand. Whilst it is an aberration in many ways, and I wouldn't want to underplay that, it's actually, it's caused there to be an acceleration of medium-term trends that we've seen. For example, in terms of how people live, work, and play, in terms of how people conduct themselves, online shopping would be a good example, an approach towards more flexible working patterns with regard to working from home, working from the office. These things were happening anyway, but I think what we've had is perhaps 3 years of progress compressed into 3 months. That's how I feel about it. So the high-quality assets that are fit for purpose into the future is where we've positioned ourselves, and about that I feel really positive.
Well, thank you for talking through those dynamics, Bill. Let's change tack slightly. Go to Tim now. Tim, this is something you wrote about in the CIO Outlook. What are investment beliefs and where do they fit in the portfolio construction process?
Hi there, Max, and morning, everyone. Yes, that's right. So this did feature in our recent piece. This question of what are investment beliefs, how do they fit in the portfolio construction process? The slide up on screen now is showing our investment process. We've got 8 steps, and investment beliefs are the first step in that process, and they do really underpin any investment process, because if you're going to act in a way you're going to invest, you're going to have to have beliefs about what you're going to do. And we're not talking here about faith or things like that. We're talking about evidence-based reasons why you're going to act in a certain way. So this, for example, could be beliefs about markets, beliefs about risk, beliefs about governance and the way you're going to invest, and beliefs about what your competitive advantages are as an institutional investor. So we've got a few examples shown on the slide there. Now, everyone has investment beliefs, and some may be explicit and some may be implicit. So, for example, why do we invest in equities? Fundamentally, that's because we believe that there's an equity risk premium and that we're going to get rewarded for investing in equities over the long term. So, some people might say, well, yes, I have investment beliefs, and that's fine. But it's really helpful, I think, to spend some time thinking about investment beliefs, and particularly situations as we've seen over the last few months where decisions have to be made quickly and made with less than perfect information. Really, a good set of well-structured investment beliefs can be invaluable because, what are a couple of points here on investment beliefs? You're trying to, if you're making a decision as an institutional investor, you're probably trying to get decisions from different people, and people may have different views on things. So coming together as a group and agreeing a consistent set of investment beliefs that everyone can get on board with means that everyone can be rowing in the same direction. Everyone knows what's trying to be achieved. And this is true if you're delegating decisions to people as well. You want to make sure that in your portfolio, you're not doing different things in different places. The other point to bear in mind is that investment beliefs can well-formed investment beliefs can serve as heuristics or rules of thumb. So because often when we're making investment decisions, we're having to do it with limited time or limited information. So in an ideal world, you might say, well, I'm going to think about this decision as much as possible. I'm going to do all the evidence and all the research I can. That's ideal, but a lot of the time you have to make decisions quickly. And having a well-thought-through investment belief gives you that rule of thumb that enables you to maybe react more quickly. So, for example, if you've got a belief that markets are generally efficient, but sometimes they overreact to events, well, that might inform how you would behave in a crisis. So if markets do fall significantly, do you need to react quickly? Are there opportunities to take advantage of? Those are some of the things I think to think about on investment beliefs and why they can be useful for institutional investors.
Great. Thanks for that insight, Tim, on how critical investment beliefs can be during periods of market turbulence such as that we've seen in recent months, and of course more broadly as well. Let's move back to Bill now. Bill, you touched on this earlier, and yes, when you were back on the call in April, you sketched out potential long-term changes to how we might live and work after the pandemic. How have your views evolved since then?
Thanks, Max. Yeah, I think my views are continuing to evolve, but I would restate a fundamental facet of what I would have said last time around. I do think this pandemic has caused people and businesses to challenge themselves and rethink convention in a range of areas. I certainly think the pattern going forward of how people work in an office environment will be materially different. I certainly don't subscribe to the demise of offices, but what I do think is that there'll be more fluidity between how people work from one place or another. As I said, a continuation of trends we've seen in recent years in any event. And I do think offices will need to be places that are really seen as being adding value and delivering the benefit of, for example, collaboration or use of certain sorts of scenarios where people can interact and get the best out of each other, as opposed to this the obligation, it seems, for people to feel that they're not working unless they're in the office. I think that will probably have changed now forever. In terms of the retail and leisure space, which has been particularly challenged by the COVID environment, and obviously alongside online shopping and technology to allow people to have leisure in their own time, there I do think that the real estate sector is going to have to reimagine what it does to be sufficiently attractive. I think it will be no longer sufficient to provide shops or leisure opportunities that are bland and average and same old, same old. I think this is going to have to be addressed by the industry, where we are capable of creating something that connects with communities for sure, but also genuine excitement, something that's vibrant, something that is current and relevant. And I think in one way I see it as being an exciting future for the sector, because it's going to have to change, but not everyone's going to be equipped to deal with that. So what I'm saying, Max, there are some real changes here, and we shouldn't just expect to go back to some sort of a pre-COVID environment. I think there are some material differences in how society operates that we're going to have to adapt to.
Well, thank you for that fascinating perspective, Bill. Let's go back to Tim for one more quick question before we move to Sonia to conclude. Tim, given the economic backdrop, how concerned should defined benefit pension schemes be about covenant or sponsor risk, and what can they do about this?
Thanks, Max. Yes, so clearly at the moment, a lot of trustees will be concerned about the strength of sponsoring employers, given what's happening in the economy. And I guess they might have two sorts of concerns, really. They might have short-term concerns about cash flows for those employers, so the liquidity. But they might also have longer-term concerns about the ongoing business viability in a more difficult economic environment. So on the first of those points, previously the pensions regulator said that trustees could suspend contribution requirements for a few months if that was going to help the employer. And the pensions regulator updated their guidance on this last week. They estimated that about 10% of schemes had actually done that so far over the last few months, who had agreed a temporary suspension of contributions. But they did say that if that was going to be the case going forward, they wanted trustees to be now placing more scrutiny. They thought, you know, we're sort of out of the crisis period. Now there needs to be scrutiny of company finances if there is going to be a suspension of deficit contributions. So they're saying trustees should be examining what's going on with the company. So this is enhanced monitoring of sponsor covenants, and with a big focus really on the equitable treatment of the pension scheme relative to other creditors. So consider, are the dividends being paid out? Are there other cash leakages going out of the sponsor? Keep an eye on that and make sure that the scheme is treated the same. The other things that trustees can do, as well as the sort of enhanced covenant monitoring that I mentioned before, if there's a concern about the longer-term business viability, then trustees might actually want to call a valuation and revisit the funding position and the contributions over the longer term and just see where they stand. The other thing they can do is review the investment strategy. So during the last few months, schemes that were well diversified did have good liability hedging protection in place and had a good governance structure so they could react quickly, capture opportunities, for example, the higher credit spreads. They have done better in the past few months. So there are things that schemes can do there on the investment side, given that, of course, getting additional contributions may be difficult in the current environment.
Right. Well, thanks for that, Tim. Sonia, one final question before we finish up. Are greater protectionism and higher taxation inevitable structural shifts in a post-COVID-19 world? And if so, what would this mean for investors? And then is there anything else you'd like to add before we finish up this morning?
Thank you, Max. Clearly, protectionism and taxation will be topics that I believe will be quite prominent in a post-COVID world, although protectionism, to be fair, I think has probably only seen an acceleration because it has been a topic that was on our agenda prior to COVID-19. But I think what we should think about on a medium-term or longer-term basis is obviously the implication of the massive fiscal stimulus programs that have been announced over the past couple of weeks, which amount, I think, in total on an average 6% of global GDP. Now, as we know, that needs to be financed, and what we do know clearly is that not all countries have entered the crisis on a stable footing or on a healthy footing when it comes to fiscal balances. And so as Geeta Gopinath, the IMF chief economist, reminded us yesterday, that obviously will come with its challenges because we will reach on a global basis a record debt level that exceeds the one experienced post-World War II. And this will come with budget deficits that again will reach levels not seen prior to this pandemic. and hence obviously the long-term viability and the fiscal sustainability of individual countries will come under a lot of scrutiny, and there will have to be very sound plans on how to rest these. Hence, obviously, for us, this is not a story, and clearly markets are not necessarily paying attention to this in 2020 and clearly not in 2021, but it's definitely something that in the medium to long term we'll see, you know, its impact on various countries. And I think here that the issue is that obviously every country is in a different position, and there will be very strong relative differences how countries can manage that impact. And as such, obviously, again, it is very much in line with what we have heard again today, is the context of putting this in the right framework, understanding the implication on market valuations, and hence identifying the opportunities that will arise. It is about risk mitigation, and it has to be the balance between the two. But there will clearly emerge long-term structural winners in this crisis. That it is about identifying these, and hence putting money to work.
Thank you, Tonya. That's a great point on which to end this week's call. I'd like to thank you, Bill, and Tim for your time today, and all of our clients for logging in. All of our podcast listeners can find a link to the slides in this episode's show notes. And we'll be back again in 2 weeks' time when Sonia will be joined by Howie Lee and Fadi Zaher.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.